This is Audible.
The information contained in this book is provided for general purposes only. It is not intended as and should not be relied upon as medical advice. The publishers and authors are not responsible for any specific health or allergy needs that may require medical supervision. If you have underlying health problems or have any doubts about the advice contained in this book, you should contact a qualified medical, dietary, or other appropriate professional. Please refer to the accompanying PDF for the FAST diet reference materials. Simon & Schuster Audio presents The FAST Diet. Lose weight, stay healthy, and live longer with the simple secret of intermittent fasting by Dr. Michael Mosley and Mimi Spencer. Read by the authors.
Introduction. Over the last few decades, food fads have come and gone, but the standard medical advice on what constitutes a healthy lifestyle has stayed much the same. Eat low-fat foods, exercise more, and never, ever skip meals. Over that same period, levels of obesity worldwide have soared. So, is there a different, evidence-based approach? One that relies on science, not opinion. Well, we think there is. Intermittent fasting. When we first read about the alleged benefits of intermittent fasting, we, like many, were sceptical. Fasting seemed drastic, difficult, and we both knew that dieting of any description is generally doomed to fail. But now that we've looked at it in depth, and tried it for ourselves, we are convinced of its remarkable potential. As one of the medical experts interviewed for this book put it, there is nothing else you can do to your body that is as powerful as fasting. Fasting is an ancient idea, but a modern method. Fasting is nothing new. As we'll discover in the next chapter, your body is designed to fast. We evolved at a time when food was scarce. We are the product of millennia of feast and famine. The reason we respond so well to intermittent fasting is that it mimics, far more accurately than three meals a day, the environment in which modern humans were shaped. Fasting, of course, remains an article of faith for many. The fasts of Lent, Yom Kippur, and Ramadan are just some of the better-known examples. Greek Orthodox Christians are encouraged to fast for 180 days of the year. According to St. Nikolai of Zika, gluttony makes a man gloomy and fearful, but fasting makes him joyful and courageous. While Buddhist monks fast on the new moon and full moon of each lunar month. Many more of us, however, seem to be eating most of the time. We are rarely ever hungry, but we are dissatisfied with our weight, our bodies, our health. Intermittent fasting can put us back in touch with our human selves. It is a route not only to weight loss, but also to long-term health and well-being. Scientists are only just beginning to discover and prove how powerful a tool it can be. This book is a product of that cutting-edge research and its impact on our current thinking about weight loss, disease resistance, and longevity. But it is also the result of our personal experience. Both are relevant here, the lab and the lifestyle. So we investigate intermittent fasting from two complementary perspectives. I used my body and my medical training to test its potential. So I will explain the scientific foundations of intermittent fasting and the 5-2 diet, something I brought to the world's attention in the summer of 2012.
Then I, Mimi, offer a practical guide on how to do it safely, effectively, and in a sustainable way, a way that will fit easily into your normal everyday life. I will look in detail at how fasting feels, what you can expect from day to day, what to eat and when to eat, and I provide a host of tips and strategies to help you gain the greatest benefit from the diet's simple precepts. As you'll hear shortly, the fast diet has changed both of our lives. We hope it will do the same for you.
As you will have gathered, I am Michael Moseley. I did a first degree at Oxford University before training to be a doctor at the Royal Free Hospital in London. After qualifying, I joined the BBC, where I have been a science journalist, executive producer, and more recently, a television presenter. Unusually, I've written and presented series on BBC 1, 2, 3, and 4, as well as BBC Radio 4. I have been named Medical Journalist of the Year by the British Medical Association, and my programmes have won a Royal Television Society Award. My wife is a doctor, and one of our 4 children is at medical school.
And I am Mimi Spencer. For more than 20 years, I've written features for national newspapers and magazines in the UK, including The Observer, The Times, Vogue, and Harper's Bazaar. As the fashion editor of the London Evening Standard, I won the British Fashion Journalist of the Year Award in 2000, and went on to edit the paper's weekly title, ES Magazine. I have written a column in You magazine at the Mail on Sunday for over a decade. And in 2009, drawing on my personal and career interest in women's attitudes to weight loss, I wrote 101 Things to Do Before You Diet, which was published by Doubleday and Rodale. Now I write regularly on women's issues and lifestyle for the Saturday Times, Marie Claire, Red, and other magazines. I live in Brighton on the south coast of England with my husband, 2 children, a small boat, and an endlessly hungry dog.
Michael's motivation, a male perspective. I am a 55-year-old male. Before I embarked on my exploration of intermittent fasting, I was mildly overweight. At 5 feet 11, 1.8 metres, I weighed around 187 pounds, that's 85 kilos, and I had a body mass index, BMI, of 26. This put me into the overweight category. Until my mid-30s, I had been slim, but like many people, I then gradually put on weight, around a pound or half a kilo a year. This doesn't sound much, but over a couple of decades, it pushed me up and up. Slowly, I realized I was starting to resemble my father, a man who struggled with his weight all his life. He died in his early 70s of complications associated with diabetes. At his funeral, many of his friends commented on how like him I had become. I was fortunate enough, while making a documentary for the BBC, to have an MRI scan done. This revealed that I am a toffee, thin on the outside and fat inside. This is the most dangerous sort of fat, visceral fat, because it wraps itself around your internal organs and puts you at increased risk of heart disease and diabetes. I later had blood tests done that showed I was heading towards diabetes, with a cholesterol score that was way too high. Clearly, I was going to have to do something about this. I tried following standard advice, except it made little difference. My weight and blood profile remained stuck in the danger ahead zone. I had never tried dieting before, but I had never found a diet that I thought would work. I watched my father try every form of diet, from Scarsdale through Atkins, from the Cambridge diet to the drinking man's diet. He lost weight on each one of them, and then, within a few months, he put it all back on, and more. Then, at the beginning of 2012, I was approached by Aidan Laverty, editor of the BBC science series Horizon. He asked me if I would like to put myself forward as a guinea pig, to explore the science behind life extension. I wasn't sure what we would find, but along with producer Kate Dart and researcher Roshan Samarasinghe, we quickly focused on calorie restriction and fasting as a fruitful area to explore. Calorie restriction, also known as CR, is pretty brutal. It involves eating an awful lot less than a normal person would expect to eat, and doing so for every day of your, hopefully, long life. The reason people put themselves through this is that it is the only intervention that has ever been shown to extend lifespan, at least in animals. There are at least 10,000 cronies, calorie restrictors on optimal nutrition, worldwide, and I have met quite a number of them. Despite their generally fabulous biochemical profile, I have never been seriously tempted to join their skinny ranks. I simply don't have the willpower or desire to live permanently on an extremely low-calorie diet. So I was delighted to discover intermittent fasting, IF. This involves eating fewer calories, but only some of the time. If the science was right, it offered the benefits of calorie restriction, but without the pain. I set off around the US, meeting leading scientists who generously shared their research and their ideas with me. It became clear that intermittent fasting was no fad. But it wouldn't be as easy as I had originally hoped. As you'll see later in the book, there are many different forms of intermittent fasting. Some involve eating nothing for 24 hours or longer. Others involve a single low-calorie meal once a day, every other day. I tried both these approaches, but I couldn't imagine doing either on a regular basis. I found it was simply too hard. Instead, I decided to create and test my own modified version. 5 days a week, I would eat normally. On the remaining two, I would eat a quarter of my usual calorie intake, around 600 calories. I split the 600 calories in two, around 250 calories for breakfast and 350 calories for supper. Effectively, I was fasting for 12 hours at a stretch. I also decided to split my fasting days. I would fast on Mondays and Thursdays. I became my own experiment. The program Eat, Fast, Live Longer, which detailed my adventures with what we were now calling the 5-2 diet, went out on the BBC during the London Olympics in August 2012. I expected it to be lost in the media frenzy that surrounded the Olympic Games, but instead it generated a frenzy all of its own. The programme was watched by over 2.5 million people, which is a big audience for Horizon, and hundreds of thousands more watched it on YouTube. My Twitter account, at Dr. Michael Mosley, went into overdrive. My followers tripled. Everyone wanted to try my version of intermittent fasting, and they were all asking me, what should they do? The newspapers took up the story. Articles appeared in the London Times, the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, and the Mail on Sunday. Before long, it was picked up by newspapers all over the world. In New York, Los Angeles, Paris, Madrid, Montreal, Islamabad, and Delhi. Online groups were created, menus and experiences swapped. Chat rooms started buzzing about fasting. People began to stop me on the street and tell me how well they were doing on the 5-2 diet. They also emailed me details of their experiences. Amongst those emails, a surprisingly large number were from doctors. Like me, they had initially been skeptical, but they had tried it for themselves, found that it worked, and began suggesting it to their patients. They wanted information, menus, details of the scientific research to scrutinize. They wanted me to write a book. I hedged, procrastinated, then finally found a collaborator, Mimi Spencer, whom I liked and trusted, and who has an in-depth knowledge of food, which is how what you are hearing now came about.
My motivation, a female perspective. I started intermittent fasting on the day I was commissioned to write a feature for The Times about Michael's Horizon program. It was the first I'd heard of intermittent fasting, and the idea appealed immediately, even to a cynical soul who has spent 2 decades examining the curious acrobatics of the fashion industry, the beauty business, and the diet trade. I'd dabbled in diets before. Show me a 40-something woman who hasn't. Losing weight, then losing faith within weeks, and piling it all back on. I'd long been interested in dropping that reluctant half a stone or more, the pounds I picked up in pregnancy and somehow never lost. The diets I tried were always too hard to follow, too complicated to implement, too boring, too tough, too single-strand, too invasive, sucking the juice out of life and leaving you with the scraps. There was nothing I found that I could adopt and thread into the context of my life, as a mother, a working woman, a wife. I've argued for years that dieting is a fool's game, doomed to fail because of the restrictions and deprivations imposed on an otherwise happy life, but this felt immediately different. The scientific evidence was extensive and compelling, and, crucially for me, the medical community was positive. The effects, for Michael and others, were impressive, startling even. In his Horizon documentary, Michael called it the beginning of something huge which could radically transform the nation's health. I couldn't resist, nor could I conceive of a reason to wait. In the months since I wrote the Times feature, I've remained a convert. An evangelist, actually. I'm still on the fast diet now, but I barely notice it. At the outset, I weighed 60 kilograms, around 9.5 stone. At 1.70 meters, 5'7", my body mass index was an okay 21.4. Today, as I speak, I weigh 54 kilograms, 8.5 stone, with a BMI of 19.4. That's a weight off. I feel light, lean, and alive. Fasting has become part of my weekly life, something I do automatically without stressing about it. Almost a year in, I have more energy, more bounce, clearer skin, a greater zest for life. And, it has to be said, new jeans, 27-inch waist, and none of my annual bikini dread as summer approaches. But, perhaps more importantly, I know that there's a long-term gain. I'm doing the best for my body and my brain. It's an intimate revelation, but one worth sharing. My background. I've written about fashion, food and body shape in national newspapers and magazines for 20 years, starting out at Vogue, followed by The Guardian, The Observer and the London Evening Standard, where I was named British Fashion Journalist of the Year in 2000. I'm currently a columnist for the Mail on Sunday's You magazine and a regular feature writer for the Saturday Times. In 2009, I wrote a book, 101 Things to Do Before You Diet, cataloguing my dismay with fad regimes and their hopeless yo-yo of loss and gain. Intermittent fasting is the only plan I have discovered in 2 decades that gets the weight off and keeps it off. And the anti-aging health benefits? Gravy. The fast diet, the potential, the promise. We know that for many people, the standard diet advice simply does not work. The fast diet is a radical alternative. It has the potential to change the way we think about eating and weight loss. Here's why. The fast diet demands we think not just about what we eat, but when we eat it. There are no complicated rules to follow. The strategy is flexible, comprehensive, and user-friendly. There is no daily slog of calorie control, none of the boredom, frustration, or cereal deprivation that characterize conventional diet plans. Yes, it involves fasting, but not as you know it. You won't starve on any given day. You will still enjoy the foods you love most of the time. Once the weight is off, sticking to the basic program will mean that it stays off. Weight loss is only one benefit of the fast diet. The real dividend is in the potential long-term health gains, cutting your risk of a range of diseases, including diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. You will soon come to understand that it is not just a diet. It's much more than that. It is a sustainable strategy for a healthy, long life. Now you'll want to understand exactly how we can make these dramatic assertions. In the next chapter, Michael explains the science that makes the fast diet tick.
The science of fasting. For most animals out in the wild, periods of feast and famine are the norm. Our remote ancestors did not often eat 4 or 5 meals a day. Instead, they would kill, gorge, lie around, and then have to go for long periods of time without having anything to eat. Our bodies and our genes were forged in an environment of scarcity, punctuated by the occasional massive blowout. These days, of course, things are very different. We eat all the time. Fasting, the voluntary abstaining from eating food or certain types of food, is seen as a rather eccentric, not to mention unhealthy, thing to do. Most of us expect to eat at least 3 meals a day and have substantial snacks in between. In addition to the meals and the snacks, we also graze. A milky cappuccino here, the odd biscuit there, or maybe a smoothie because it's healthier. Once upon a time, parents told their children not to eat between meals. Those times are long gone. Recent research in the US, which compared the eating habits of 28,000 children and 36,000 adults over the last 30 years, found that the amount of time spent between what the researchers coyly described as eating occasions has fallen by an average of an hour. In other words, over the last few decades, the amount of time we spend not eating has dropped dramatically. In the 1970s, people like my mother would go around 4.5 hours between meals. Now it's down to 3.5 hours for adults and 3 hours for children. And that doesn't include all the drinks and nibbles. The idea that eating little and often is a good thing has partly been driven by snack manufacturers and by faddish diet books, but it has also had support from the medical establishment. Their argument is it is better to eat lots of small meals because that way we are less likely to get hungry and gorge on high-fat junk. Now, I can appreciate the argument, and there have been some studies that suggest there are some health benefits to to eating small meals regularly, as long as you don't simply end up eating more. Unfortunately, in the real world, that is exactly what happens. In the study I quoted above, they found that, compared to 30 years ago, we not only eat around 180 calories a day more in snacks, much of it in the form of milky and fizzy drinks and smoothies, but we also eat more when it comes to our regular meals, up by an average of 120 calories a day. In other words, snacking doesn't seem to mean we eat less at mealtimes. It just whets the appetite. Eating throughout the day is now so normal, so much the expected thing to do, that it is almost shocking to suggest there is value in doing the absolute opposite. When I first started fasting, I discovered some unexpected things about myself, my attitudes to food, and about my beliefs. I discovered I often eat when I don't need to. I do it because the food is there, because I'm afraid I will get hungry later, or simply from habit. I assumed that when you get hungry, it builds and builds until it becomes intolerable, and you bury your face in a vat of ice cream. I found instead that hunger passes, and once you have been really hungry, you no longer fear it. I thought that fasting would make me distractible, unable to concentrate. What I've discovered is that it sharpens my senses and my brain. I wondered if I would feel faint for much of the time. It turns out that the body is incredibly adaptable, and many athletes I've spoken to advocate training while fasting. I feared it would be hard to do. It isn't. So why did I get started? Although most of the great religions advocate fasting, the Sikhs are an exception, though they do allow fasting for medical reasons, I've always assumed that this was principally a way of testing yourself and your faith. I could see potential spiritual benefits, but I was deeply skeptical about the physical benefits. I've had a number of body-conscious friends who, down the years, have tried to get me to fast, but I could never accept their explanation that the reason for doing so was to rest the liver or remove the toxins. Neither explanation made any sense to a medically trained skeptic like me. I remember one friend telling me that after a couple of weeks of fasting, his urine had turned black, proof that the toxins were leaving. I saw it as proof that he was an ignorant hippie, and that whatever was going on inside his body as a result of fasting was extremely damaging. As I said in the introduction, what convinced me to try fasting was a combination of my own personal circumstances. I was in my mid-50s, with a high blood sugar, slightly overweight, and the emerging scientific evidence, which I will now discuss. That which does not kill us makes us stronger. There were a number of researchers who inspired me in their different ways, but one who stands out is Professor Mark Mattson of the National Institute on Aging in Baltimore. A couple of years ago, he wrote an article with Edward Calabrese in The New Scientist magazine. It was titled, "When a Little Poison is Good for You." It really made me sit up and think. "A Little Poison is Good for You" is a colourful way of describing the theory of hormesis, the idea that when a human, or indeed any other creature, is exposed to a stress or a toxin, it can toughen them up. Hormesis is not just a variant of "join the army and it will make a man of you." It is now a well-accepted explanation in biology of how things operate at the cellular level. Take, for example, something as simple as exercise. When you run or pump iron, what you're actually doing is damaging your muscles, causing small tears and rips. If you don't completely overdo it, then your body responds by doing repairs, and in the process makes the muscles stronger. Vegetables are another example. We all know we should eat lots of fruit and vegetables because they are chock full of antioxidants. And antioxidants are great because they mop up the dangerous free radicals that roam our bodies doing harm. The trouble with this widely accepted explanation of how fruit and vegetables work is that it is almost certainly wrong, or at least incomplete. The levels of antioxidants in fruit and vegetables are far too low to have the profound effects they clearly do. In addition, the attempts to extract antioxidants from plants and then give them to us in a concentrated form, as a health-inducing supplement, have been unconvincing when tested in long-term trials. Beta-carotene, when you give it in the form of a carrot, is undoubtedly good for you. But when they took beta-carotene out of the carrot and gave it as a supplement to patients with cancer, it actually seemed to make them worse. If we look through the prism of hormesis at the way that vegetables work in our bodies, we can see that the reasons for their benefits may be quite different. Consider this apparent paradox. Bitterness is often associated in the wild with poisons, something to be avoided. Plants produce a huge range of so-called phytochemicals, and some of them act as natural pesticides to keep mammals like us from eating them. The fact they taste bitter is a clear warning signal. Keep away. So there are good evolutionary reasons why we should dislike and avoid bitter-tasting foods. Yet some of the vegetables that are particularly good for us, such as cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, and other members of the brassica family, are so bitter that even as adults, many of us struggle to love them. The resolution to this paradox is that these vegetables taste bitter because they contain chemicals that are potentially poisonous. The reason they don't harm us is that these chemicals are present in them at low doses that are not toxic. Rather, they activate stress responses and switch on genes that protect and repair. Once you start looking at the world in this way, you realize that many activities we initially find stressful, like eating bitter vegetables, going for a run, or intermittent fasting, are far from harmful. The challenge itself seems to be part of the benefit. The fact that prolonged starvation is clearly very bad for you does not imply that short periods of intermittent fasting must be a little bad for you. Indeed, the reverse is true. This point was vividly made to me by Professor Walter Longo, director of the University of Southern California's Longevity Institute. His research is mainly into the study of why we age, particularly concerning approaches that reduce the risk of developing age-related diseases, such as cancer and diabetes. I went to see Walter, not just because he is a world expert, but also because he had kindly agreed to act as my fasting mentor and buddy, to help inspire and guide me through my first experiences of fasting. Walter has been studying fasting for many years, and he is a keen adherent of it. He lives by his own research and thrives on the sort of low-protein, high-vegetable diet that his grandparents enjoy in southern Italy. Perhaps not coincidentally, his grandparents live in a part of Italy that has an extraordinarily high concentration of long-lived people. As well as following a fairly strict diet, Walter skips lunch to keep his weight down. Beyond this, once every 6 months or so, he does a prolonged fast that lasts several days. Tall, slim, energetic, Italian, he is an inspiring poster boy for would-be fasters. The main reason he is so enthusiastic about fasting is that his research, and that of others, has demonstrated the extraordinary range of measurable health benefits that you can get from doing it. Going without food for even quite short periods of time switches on a number of repair genes, which, as he explained, can confer long-term benefits. There is a lot of initial evidence to suggest that temporary periodic fasting can induce long-lasting changes that can be beneficial against aging and diseases, he told me. You take a person, you fast them. After 24 hours, everything is revolutionized. And even if you took a cocktail of drugs, very potent drugs, you will never, ever get close to what fasting does. The beauty of fasting is that it is all coordinated. Fasting and longevity. Most of the early long-term studies on the benefits of fasting were done in rodents. They also gave us important insights into the molecular mechanisms that underpin fasting. In one early study from 1945, mice were fasted for either 1 day in 4, 1 day in 3, or 1 day in 2. The researchers found that the fasted mice lived longer than a control group who did not fast. And the more they fasted, the longer they lived. They also found that unlike calorie-restricted mice, the fasted mice were not physically stunted. Since then, numerous studies have confirmed, at least in rodents, the value of fasting. But why does fasting help? What is the mechanism? Volta has access to his own supply of genetically engineered mice, known as dwarf or Laron mice, which he was keen to show me. These mice, though small, hold the record for longevity extension in a mammal. In other words, they live for an astonishingly long time. The average lab mouse doesn't live that long, perhaps 2 years. Laron mice can live twice that, many for almost 4 years when they're also calorie restricted. In a human, that would be the equivalent of reaching almost 170. The fascinating thing about Laron mice is not just their longevity, but the fact that they stay healthy for most of their very long lives. They simply don't seem to be prone to diabetes or cancer, and when they die, more often than not, it is of natural causes. Volta told me that on autopsy, they are often unable to find a cause of death. The mice just seem to drop dead. The reason these mice are so small and so long-lived is they are genetically engineered, so their bodies do not respond to a hormone called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. IGF-1, as its name implies, has growth-promoting effects on almost every cell in your body. It keeps your cells constantly active. Now, you need adequate levels of IGF-1 and other growth factors when you are young and growing. But high levels later in life appear to lead to accelerated aging and cancer. As Volta put it, it's like driving along with your foot flat on the accelerator, pushing the car to continue to perform all the time. Imagine, instead of occasionally taking your car to the garage and changing the parts and pieces, you simply kept on driving it and driving it. Well, the car, of course, is going to break down. Volta's work is focused on trying to work out how you can go on driving as much as possible and as fast as possible while still enjoying life. He thinks the answer is periodic fasting, because one of the ways fasting seems to work is by making your body reduce the amount of IGF-1 it produces. The evidence that IGF-1 plays a key role in many of the diseases of aging comes not just from rodents like the Laron mice, but also from humans. For the last 7 years, Volta has been studying villagers in Ecuador with a genetic defect also called Laron syndrome. This is an extremely rare condition which affects fewer than 350 people in the world. People with Laron syndrome have bodies which don't seem to respond to IGF-1. There's a specific mutation in the growth hormone receptor, causing a deficiency that is very similar to that in the Laron mouse. The villagers with Le Ron syndrome are normally quite short. Many are less than 4 feet tall. The thing that is most surprising about them, however, is that like the Le Ron mice, they simply don't seem to develop common diseases like diabetes and cancer. In fact, Volter says that though they have been studied for many years, there is not a single case he has come across of someone with Le Ron dying of cancer. Yet their relatives who live in the same household but who don't have Le Ron syndrome get cancer like everyone else. Disappointingly, for anyone who is hoping that IGF-1 will provide the secrets of immortality, people with Le Ron syndrome, unlike the mice, are not exceptionally long-lived. They certainly lead long lives, but not super long lives. Volta thinks one reason for this may be they tend to enjoy life rather than worry about their lifestyle. Volta told me they smoke, eat a high-calorie diet, and then they look at me and they say, "Oh, it doesn't matter, I'm immune." Volta thinks they prefer the idea of living as they want and dying at 85, rather than living more carefully and perhaps going beyond 100. He would like to persuade some of them to take on a more healthy lifestyle and see what happens, but he knows he wouldn't live long enough to see the outcome. Fasting and repair genes. As well as reducing circulating levels of IGF-1, fasting also appears to switch on a number of repair genes. The reason this happens is not fully understood, but the evolutionary argument goes something like this. As long as we have plenty of food, our bodies are mainly interested in growing, having sex, and reproducing. Nature has no long-term plans for us. She does not invest in our old age. Once we have reproduced, we become disposable. So what happens if you decide to fast? Well, the body's initial reaction is one of shock. Signals go to the brain, reminding you that you are hungry, urging you to go out and find something to eat. But you resist. The body now decides that the only reason you are not eating as much and as frequently as you usually do must be because you are now in a famine situation. In the past, this would have been quite normal. In a famine situation, there is no point in expending energy on growth or sex. Instead, the wisest thing the body can do is to spend its precious store of energy on repair, trying to keep you in reasonable shape until the good times return once more. The result is that as well as removing its foot from the accelerator, your body takes itself along to the cellular equivalent of a garage. There, all the little gene mechanics are ordered to start doing some of the urgent maintenance tasks that have been put off till now. One of the things that calorie restriction does, for example, is to switch on a process called autophagy. Autophagy, meaning self-eat, is a process by which the body breaks down and recycles old and tired cells. Just as with a car, it is important to get rid of damaged or aging parts if you are going to keep things in good working order. Volta thinks the majority of people with a body mass index over 25 would benefit from fasting. But he also thinks that if you plan to do it for more than a day or so, it should be done in a proper centre. As he put it, a prolonged fast is an extreme intervention. If it's done well, it can be very powerful in your favour. If it's done improperly, it can be very powerful against you. With a prolonged fast lasting several days, you can get a drop in blood pressure and some fairly profound metabolic reprogramming. Some people faint. It's not common, but it does happen. One of Volta's areas of research is into the effects of fasting on cancer, an area I will touch on later. This seems to be optimized by prolonged rather than intermittent fasting. As he pointed out, the first time you try fasting for a few days, it can be a bit of a struggle. Our bodies are used to high levels of glucose and high levels of insulin, so it takes time to adapt, But then, eventually, he said, it's not that hard. I wasn't keen to hear eventually, but by then I knew I would have to give it a go. It was a challenge, and one I thought I could win. Brain against stomach. Surely it would be no contest. Experiencing a 4-day fast. I don't think it is either necessary or particularly desirable to do a prolonged fast before embarking on the fast diet. While there are few known risks involved in fasting for less than 24 hours, the same is not true of prolonged fasts. I decided to start with a 4-day fast because I knew I was in safe hands. I also had had my IGF-1 levels measured just before I met Volta, and they were high. Not super high, as he kindly put it, but at the top end of the range. My levels of IGF-1, or somatomedin C, as it is also known, were 28.0 nanomoles per litre. The healthy range is 11.3 to 30.9 nanomoles per litre. High levels of IGF-1 are associated with a range of cancers, amongst them prostate cancer, which had troubled my father. Would a 4-day fast change anything? I had been warned that the first few days might be tough, but after that I would start feeling the effects of a rush of what Volta termed well-being chemicals. Even better, the next time I fasted, it would be easier. My body and my brain would have a memory of it and understand what I was going through. Having decided I would try an extended fast, my next decision was how harsh to make it. A number of different countries have a tradition of fasting. The Russians seem to prefer it tough. For them, a fast consists of nothing but water, cold showers, and exercise. The Germans, on the other hand, prefer their fast to be considerably gentler. Go to a fasting clinic in Germany, and you will probably be fed around 200 calories a day in comfortable surroundings. I wanted to see results, so I went for a British compromise. I would eat 25 calories a day, no cold showers, and just try working as normal. So, on a warm Monday evening, I enjoyed my last meal, a filling dinner of steak, chips, and salad washed down with beer. I felt a certain trepidation as I realized for the next 4 days I would be drinking nothing but water, sugarless black tea and coffee, and one small cup of low-calorie soup a day. Despite what I'd been told and read before I began my fast, I secretly feared that hunger would grow and grow, gnawing away inside me until I finally gave in and ran amok in a cake shop. The first 24 hours were quite tough, but just as Volta had predicted, things gradually got better, not worse. Yes, there were hunger pangs, sometimes quite distracting, but if I kept busy, they went away. During the first 24 hours of a fast, there are some quite profound changes going on inside the body. Within a few hours, glucose circulating in the blood is consumed. If it's not being replaced by food, then the body turns to glycogen, a stable form of glucose that is stored in the muscles and in the liver. Only when that's gone does it really switch on fat burning. What actually happens is that fatty acids are broken down in the liver, resulting in the production of something called ketone bodies. The brain uses these ketone bodies as a source of energy, instead of glucose. The first 2 days of a fast can be uncomfortable, because your body and your brain are having to cope with a switch from using glucose and glycogen as a fuel to using ketone bodies. The body is not used to them, so you can get headaches, though I didn't. You may find it hard to sleep. I didn't. The biggest problem I had with fasting is hard to put into words. It was sometimes just feeling uncomfortable. I can't really describe it more accurately than that. I didn't feel faint. I just sometimes felt out of place. I did occasionally feel hungry, but most of the time I was surprisingly cheerful. By day 3, the feel-good hormones had come to my rescue. By Friday, day 4, I was almost disappointed that it was ending. Almost. Despite Volta's warning that it would be unwise to gorge immediately on breaking a fast, I got myself a plate of bacon and eggs and settled down to eat. After a few mouthfuls, I was full. I really didn't need any more, and in fact skipped lunch. That afternoon, I was tested again and discovered I had lost just under 3 pounds of body weight, a significant portion of which was fat. I was also happy to see that my blood glucose levels had fallen and that my IGF-1 levels, which had been at the top end of the recommended range, had gone right down. In fact, they had almost halved. This was all good news. I had lost fat, my blood results were looking good, and I had learnt that I can control my hunger. Volta was extremely pleased with these changes, particularly the fall in IGF-1 that he said would significantly reduce my risk of some cancers. But he also warned me that if I went back to my old lifestyle, these changes would not be permanent. Volta's research points towards the fact that high levels of protein, the amounts found in a typical Western diet, help keep IGF-1 levels high. I knew that there is protein in foods like meat and fish, but I was surprised there is also a lot in milk. I used to enjoy drinking a skinny latte most mornings. I had the illusion that because it was made with skim milk, it must be healthy. Unfortunately, though low in fat, a large latte comes in at around 11 grams of protein. And Volta recommends you don't eat more than 0.8 of a gram of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. For someone like me, that would be around 64 grams a day. A latte at 11 grams, well, that would have to go. Fasting and weight loss. One way to lose weight would be to go on a prolonged fast. I did the 4-day fast, as I've just described, mainly because I was curious. I would not recommend it as a weight loss regime because it is completely unsustainable. Unless they combine it with a vigorous exercise regime, people who go on prolonged fasts lose muscle as well as fat. Then when they stop, as they must eventually do, the risk is they will pile the weight right back on, much of it as fat. Fortunately, less drastic, intermittent fasting, the subject of this book, leads to steady and sustainable weight loss and does not cause much muscle loss. Alternate day fasting. One of the most extensively studied forms of short-term fasting is alternate day fasting, also known as ADF. As its name implies, it means you get no food, or relatively little food, every other day. One of the few researchers to have done human studies in this area is Dr. Krista Varady of the University of Illinois at Chicago. Krista is slim, charming, and very amusing. We met in an old-fashioned American diner where I guiltily ate burgers and fries, while Krista told me about one of her recent studies, which she has been carrying out with human volunteers. In this study, on fasting days, the volunteers were allowed 25% of their normal energy needs. So men were allowed around 600 calories a day, women 500 calories a day. On their fast days, they ate all their calories in one go at lunch. On their feed days, they were asked to consume 125% of their normal energy needs. Krista has done a number of studies on ADF, and what surprised her is that even when they are allowed to, people don't go crazy on their feed days. As she told me, I thought when I started running these trials that people would eat 175% the next day, that they would just fully compensate and wouldn't lose any weight. But most people eat around 110%, just slightly over what they usually eat. I haven't measured it yet, but I think it involves stomach size, how far that can expand. Eating almost twice the amount of food that you normally eat is actually pretty difficult. You can do it over time. People that are obese, their stomachs get bigger to accommodate 5,000 calories a day. But just to do it right off, well, that is actually pretty difficult. In her earlier studies, subjects were asked to stick to a low-fat diet, but what Krista wanted to find out was whether ADF would also work if her subjects were allowed to eat a typical American high-fat diet. So she asked 33 obese volunteers, most of them women, to go on ADF for 8 weeks. Before starting, the volunteers were divided into two groups. One group was put on a low-fat diet, eating low-fat cheeses and dairies, very lean meats and lots of fruit and vegetables. The other group was allowed to eat high-fat lasagnas, pizza, the sort of diet a typical American might consume. Americans consume somewhere between 35 and 45% fat in their diets. As Krista explained, the results were unexpected. The researchers and volunteers had assumed that people on the low-fat diet would lose more weight than those on a high-fat diet. But if anything, it was the other way round. The volunteers on the high-fat diet lost an average of 5.6 kilograms, that's around 12 pounds, while those on the low-fat diet lost 4.2 kilograms, just 9 pounds. They both lost around 7 centimeters, about 3 inches, around their waist. Krista thinks the main reason this happened was compliance. The volunteers randomized to the high-fat diet were more likely to stick to it than those on the low-fat diet, simply because they found it a lot more palatable. And it wasn't just weight loss. Both groups saw impressive falls in low-density lipoprotein, LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, and also falls in blood pressure. This meant they had reduced their risk of cardiovascular disease, of having a heart attack or a stroke. Now, Krista doesn't want to encourage people to binge on rubbish. She would much rather that people on ADF ate healthily, increased their fruit and vegetable intake, and generally ate less. The trouble is, as she pointed out rather exasperatedly, doctors have been encouraging people to embrace a healthy lifestyle for decades, and not enough of us are doing it. She thinks dietitians should take into account what people actually do, rather than what we would like them to do. One other significant benefit to intermittent fasting is that you don't seem to lose muscle, which you would on a normal calorie-restricted regime. Krista herself is not sure why that is and wants to do further research. The two-day fast. One of the problems with alternate day fasting, which is why I'm not so keen on it, is that you have to do it every other day. In my experience, this can be socially inconvenient as well as emotionally demanding. There is no pattern to your week, and other people, friends and family, find it hard to keep track of when your fast and feed days are. Unlike Krista's subjects, I was not particularly overweight to start with.